doctoral work. Under his watch, I studied the effect of caloric restriction, how reducing the daily calories consumed by mice and men by 30% every day affects their aging and lifespan. However, Roy and I spoke only via video conference because he had decided to lock himself away for 2 years, along with 7 other people, in a sealed environment in the middle of the Arizona desert. Called Biosphere 2, this self-imposed exile was an experiment to understand whether and how humans could survive in a completely sealed environment, producing all the food they needed. A useful experiment in the responses of humans to a highly regulated environment with possible applications for living on space stations. I went to Arizona at the end of the 2 years to welcome the 8 adventurers as they came out of Biosphere 2. As part of the experiment, they had been calorie restricted and consumed very few calories a day for 2 years. When they emerged at the end of it, they were extremely thin and looked angry. After being in Walford's UCLA lab for 2 years, I still had little insight into the secrets of aging. Mice were too complex to allow rapid identification of the genes that regulate and affect aging. Also, seeing the angry faces of the Biospherians made me think that there must be a better way than chronic calorie restriction to delay aging, and I was impatient to find it. It prompted me to move to the biochemistry department and the laboratory of Joan Valentine and Edith Gralla to study aging in baker's yeast, a simple unicellular organism that allowed me to study the molecular foundation for life, aging, and death. We think of yeast as an ingredient in bread and beer, but Saccharomyces cerevisiae, baker's yeast, is in fact one of the most studied organisms in science. This single-cell organism is inexpensive to work with and easy to study. It is so easy to work with that some scientists carry out yeast experiments at home. It's also easy to modify genetically by simply removing or adding one or more of its roughly 6,000 genes. A small group of scientists, including myself at UCLA and Brian Kennedy at MIT, decided the easiest way to understand how humans age is to identify the genes that regulate the aging of simple organisms, like yeast, and eventually move back to mice and humans. There was a big risk, however. What if our discoveries about how yeast ages had no relevance to humans? Most scientists studying aging in mice and humans had assumed that to be the case and were not that interested in our research on these very simple organisms. But I had faith it would work, and was determined to try. The risk was big, but the potential payoff, figuring out the molecular mechanisms of aging, was worth it. My first step was to define a new scientific approach to studying aging. Because aging in yeast was studied only by a method called replicative aging, which would be the equivalent to studying human aging by determining the maximum number of children a woman could have, I developed a method called yeast chronological life, and used it to identify a set of genes important to aging. This method allowed me to measure aging chronologically, in other words, the same way we measure it for humans or mice, by being able to monitor every few days how many of these microorganisms remained alive. It was 1994, and no one had ever identified a gene that regulated the aging process in any organism. Thanks to the work of Thomas Johnson at the University of Colorado and Cynthia Kenyon at UC San Francisco, it was known that genes could make worms live longer, just not what genes they were or how they worked. With 3 Nobel laureates and 7 members of the National Academy of Sciences in the pharmacology and biochemistry departments, UCLA was science heaven. I was surrounded by great geneticists, biochemists, and molecular biologists, all ready to help. I didn't even have to knock because the doors, even those of the Nobelists, were almost always open. Even so, we didn't tell people we were working on aging. Although within 10 to 15 years the field would explode, back then it was considered a strange, even crazy area of study, and we were considered an odd group. When people asked what I was working on, I would say, Free Radical Biochemistry. After just 1 year, I made two important discoveries using the method I had invented. 1. If I starved yeast by removing all the nutrients available to them and giving them only water, they lived twice as long. 2. Sugar is one of the nutrients responsible for yeast aging fast and dying early. It activates two genes, RAS and PKA, that are known to accelerate aging, and it inactivates factors and enzymes that protect against oxidation and other types of damage. In a short period in the biochemistry department, I had identified not only the first gene regulating the aging process, but also the entire signaling pathway, all thanks to a very simple organism. The system was so simple and so new that the scientific community was in disbelief and struggled to understand, let alone accept, the chronological aging system and the discovery of the pro-aging sugar pathway. Leading science journals refused to publish the findings my mentors and I found so extraordinary, so I used the discoveries as the basis for my doctoral thesis, as well as two other publications, which were ignored for several years. It wasn't until 1996 that anyone showed any interest in my discovery. The leading aging research at the time was being done on worms, and Tom Johnson, who was trying to identify an unknown gene that made worms live longer, invited me to present my data on the sugar pathway at a conference. When my presentation ended, the room was absolutely silent. The stars of the aging field, who years later would become my colleagues and friends, stared at me as if I had grown horns. No one had ever heard of the system I was working with, yeast chronological aging, nor of the genes I had identified. And anyway, very few believed that similar genes and strategies could be affecting aging in such different organisms. A few years later, encouraged by continuing to discover similarities between my findings in yeast and those of the teams studying worms, which now included Gary Ruvkin at Harvard, I published an article proposing that many, if not all, organisms age in similar ways, and that the genes and molecular strategy to achieve longer lifespans would be similar or the same in yeast, worms, mice, and, yes, humans. This was heresy, and the great majority of scientists dismissed it as a crazy idea with no relevance to human aging, since it was based on discoveries made in a microorganism. It would take another 6 years for our data on genes activated by sugars to get published, along with the discovery of the pro-aging genes activated by amino acids and proteins, see figure 2.2. 8 more years passed before different laboratories would confirm these data experimentally in mice, and another 10 years before my own lab provided initial evidence that similar genes and pathways may protect humans against age-related diseases. Knowing that dwarf yeast, with longevity mutations in the growth genes, TOR-S6K, could live up to 5 times longer than normal yeast, and that dwarf flies and mice, with similar genetic mutations, could live up to twice as long as normal mice, in 2006, I started research on the human version of the growth gene known to correlate to record longevity in mice, see figure 2.2. Through my colleague Pinkus Cohen, who is now dean of the USC Leonard Davis School of Gerontology, I learned of the work of Jaime Guevara Aguirre, an endocrinologist who had spent decades studying a community of extremely short people in Ecuador who lacked the receptor for growth hormone, a disorder known as Laron syndrome. After 5 years of working together, we published our findings, concluding that there was a major decrease in the incidence of cancer and diabetes in subjects with Laron syndrome, see figure 2.4, despite poor diet, consuming large quantities of fried food, and unhealthy lifestyle choices, smoking, drinking, etc. Our finding made this group of short individuals from remote villages in Ecuador famous around the world. Everyone wanted to hear about this group of little people who appeared to hold the secret that could protect everyone from cancer, diabetes, and possibly other diseases. We were even invited to present our research to the Pope, accompanied by one of our Loran subjects. Journalists described these people as being free from disease. "It doesn't matter what we eat," the Loran subjects told reporters, "because we are immune from diseases." Of course, this is not the case. A few have developed both cancer and diabetes, but these diseases occur rarely and much less frequently than they appear in their non-Loran relatives living in the same houses and consuming the same food. Recently, we also published our studies on the brain function of this Loran group and concluded that they have cognitive function that is typical of younger individuals. In other words, their brains appear to be younger than they are, which is in agreement with the findings published by the Andrzej-Bartke laboratory in mice with similar mutations. After these studies and many trips to Ecuador, the country, particularly the isolated Andes to the south, became a magical place for me, and I go back as often as possible. Jaime and I argue all the time, but we continue to work very closely and have forged a fruitful friendship. These findings were the last missing pieces to support my theory that similar genes and longevity programs can protect organisms, ranging from simple ones such as yeast to complex ones like humans, against aging and disease. These alternative programs, such as those found in the Loran people, have probably evolved to deal with periods of starvation by minimizing growth and aging, while also stimulating regeneration. The mutation in the growth hormone receptor gene that these Ecuadorians carry appears to force the body to enter and stay in an alternative longevity program characterized by high protection, regeneration, and low incidence of disease. The rest of the book takes advantage of this genetic knowledge to identify everyday diets and a periodic fasting-mimicking diet that can regulate genes that protect against aging and diseases. Connecting nutrients, genes, aging, and diseases. A risk factor is something that affects the probability of dying from or developing a particular disease. For example, obesity is a well-established risk factor for diabetes. It can increase by fivefold the chance of developing the disease. We think of poor nutrition, lack of exercise, and the genes we inherit from our parents as the major risk factors for diseases. But by monitoring the age at which people are diagnosed with different diseases, we know that aging itself is the main risk factor for cancer, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, and many other diseases. According to recent data, the probability that a 20-year-old woman will develop breast cancer within the next 10 years of her life is roughly 1 in 2,000. The risk is 1 in 24 for a 70-year-old woman. That's an increase by almost a factor of 100. As I have stated, my approach is different from that of almost all other nutrition books in that my program doesn't focus on achieving a healthy weight or on any one specific disease independently of the long-term consequences of a treatment. If aging is the central risk factor for all major diseases, it's much smarter to intervene on aging itself than to try to prevent and treat diseases one by one. Even great success against one disease may be minimal or rendered irrelevant if accompanied by an increased incidence of another. Few people know, for example, that curing cancer or cardiac disease today would increase the average lifespan by only a little over 3 years. The lifespan of a mouse is about 2.5 years, and tumors begin to appear in mice at the age of 1.5. People live on average more than 80 years, and most tumors begin to appear after age 50. In relative terms, that is a similar proportion of life. Therefore, we can reduce the risk of cancer and many other diseases by acting on the longevity program, and we now know that we can do this through diet. Figure 2.5 shows how sugars and proteins affect key genes and pathways widely recognized to accelerate aging, TOR-S6K, PKA, RAS, and IGF-1. To maximize and reprogram longevity in the human body, we need to continue to study how different diets control these genes and then apply the longevity program to all the diseases associated with aging. Clearly, our strategy of studying the genetics and molecular biology of longevity in simple organisms paid off, though it took many years of hard work by groups made up of mostly geneticists and molecular biologists at universities all over the world. From studying aging to solving medical problems. After studying aging, my second passion, developed while working with Walford's group at UCLA, is using the biochemistry of longevity to solve medical problems. To optimize disease prevention and treatment, we need to know what causes disease at the molecular and cellular level, and to understand how we can return those molecules and cells to their youthful, fully functioning states. To attempt to treat a disease without this information is like trying to fix a car without knowing how its engine or electrical system works. Repairing cars and planes is, of course, much simpler than repairing a sick human body. Although this is a generalization, much of medical research is based on identifying drugs that can target a specific problem associated with a disease. For example, to treat cancer, researchers developed chemotherapy and other more specific drugs that preferentially kill cancer cells. To treat multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases, scientists identified proteins and drugs that reduce the activity of specific immune cell populations or the inflammatory factors they generate. I argue that this is an incomplete approach that is not in tune with evolution, and that would greatly benefit from being combined with, and in some cases replaced by, a longevity-based approach, preferably one awakening a program already present in the human body, once this is further demonstrated to be effective. For example, by starving a mouse receiving chemotherapy or other targeted therapies, we protect normal cells and organs while making the therapy more toxic to cancer cells. And by applying cycles of a fasting-mimicking diet to a mouse with an autoimmune disease, we reduce the number of autoimmune cells while also activating regeneration of the damaged tissues. Preliminary results indicate that these strategies may also be effective in humans. While I was a research scientist working at USC, I had the opportunity to meet with children being treated for cancer at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. Italian researcher Lizia Raffaello, at the time a visiting scholar in Los Angeles, was puzzled by our effort to find ways to help people live longer and healthier lives to age 100 and beyond, when her ward was full of children who might not make it to 10. One of these patients was a girl from southern Italy. We considered isolating her neuroblastoma cells in the laboratory to study them and understand what therapy might work best. But we came up against the hard reality that this type of study was not allowed by the hospital or by my department. The girl eventually returned to Italy, and sadly, she died. I will never forget how she kept close watch on the intravenous saline solution bag, with the seriousness and maturity of a nurse ensuring a procedure is being carried out correctly. Because of the impact that girl and the other sick children I'd met had on my vision of research, I decided to divide my lab between two areas of interest and two different missions. One team of researchers would continue to work on the biochemistry and genetics of aging. The other would work to solve medical problems using strategies based on our understanding of cellular protection, repair, and regeneration, with an eye toward solutions that were inexpensive and could rapidly be translated into improved therapies. Because diet-based therapies do not involve new drugs, they can move through the Food and Drug Administration approval process quickly, and in some cases can be combined with standard-of-care drug-based therapies without FDA approval. From this effort came our discoveries of differential stress resistance and sensitization, which use prolonged fasting to push normal cells into a highly protected state while making cancer cells highly vulnerable to chemotherapy and other cancer therapies. Other dietary strategies applicable to diabetes, as well as autoimmune, cardiovascular, and neurodegenerative disorders, also came from our effort to identify simple but powerful therapies for complex problems. But before we get to the diet itself, I'll explain how I've harnessed 30 years of research, both mine and that of other labs, to identify daily diets as well as periodic fasting-mimicking diets with the potential to extend healthy human longevity. Chapter 3. The Five Pillars. The Longevity Revolution. Most popular diets, and the experts behind them, fail to take into consideration the most important reason to adopt a diet in the first place: living to a very old age and dying healthy. We are so used to associating death with cancer, heart disease, or another illness that the concept of dying healthy seems alien. But this is the promise of the longevity revolution. Indeed, the concept is now strongly supported by experiments in simple organisms, mice, rats, monkeys, and humans. Based on biogerontology, study of the biology of aging, preventive medicine, and longevity research, we now know that the later years of life, even when life is extended, need not be associated with poor health and disease. For example, the mice and rats we treat in the lab with different longevity diets live up to 40% longer and have far fewer diseases despite their longer lifespan compared to mice on standard diets. Long-term studies of monkeys on a calorie-restricted diet demonstrate a major reduction in disease incidence as well as lifespan extension. This is consistent with our recent study associating high protein intake with cancer and mortality in humans. In addition, we discovered that, as with the long-lived mice lacking growth hormone receptors, the Ecuadorian people with the same deficiency in the GH receptor rarely develop either diabetes or cancer and appear to be protected from age-dependent cognitive decline and possibly other diseases. Thus, dietary interventions that affect particular genes or genetic changes in those genes directly can extend not only longevity, but healthy longevity in mice, primates, and humans. According to these studies, a precise longevity diet accompanied by periodic fasting-mimicking diets, which I describe in chapters 4 and 6 respectively, can, by regulating the set of longevity genes, extend the healthy lifespan. I've been lucky to see this kind of healthy longevity with my own eyes. In the past 10 years, I was able to make many visits to the two oldest people in Italy, Salvatore Caruso, 110, and Emma Murano, 117, who have both now passed away. Emma was also the oldest living person in the world and the oldest ever in Italy's recorded history. Both retained good memory skills, engaged in many activities on their own into old age, and were remarkable examples of healthy longevity. Emma exemplifies the importance of genetics on longevity. Her diet wasn't particularly healthy, whereas Salvatore shows the influence of diet on human health. Thus, the study of people and populations with record longevity represents one of the key pillars I have used to identify the longevity diet described in this book. Who do you listen to? Among the longevity factors within your control, what you eat is the primary choice you can make that will affect whether you live to 60, 80, 100, or 110, and more important, whether you will get there in good health. So, when it comes to dietary recommendations, it's crucial to listen to the right people. In an internet-centered world, perhaps the most dangerous development for your health is the chaos generated by the idea that everyone can give dietary advice. It is essential to determine whether a so-called diet expert has the appropriate range of knowledge before deciding whether he or she is qualified to give you dietary advice. On a recent train ride from Milan to Genoa, I had one of many entertaining experiences underlining that everyone believes themselves to be a diet expert. An old building administrator from Genoa explained how his wife's omelets were the key to maintaining his weight and health. The woman next to him protested that eggs have high cholesterol and that her pasta and zucchini were much healthier. When five such dietary experts had made their recommendations, They wondered why I had not jumped in. "I think you'd better cut down on the number of fried eggs per week," I told the retired administrator. "You know, I don't think I like you," he replied. Because everyone eats, everyone feels he or she knows enough about food and health to give advice. Recently, a woman asked me what I thought she and her son should eat to stay healthy. After hearing my advice, she responded, "I think the best thing to do is to eat everything in moderation." I asked her, "Would you fly on an airplane that you had personally designed?" She knew the correct answer to that question was absolutely not. Most planes are designed by teams of world-class engineers working at major aviation companies like Boeing and Airbus, using technology and insights going back to the Wright brothers and even Leonardo da Vinci. Why would you be willing to make key decisions that affect whether you and your loved ones will get cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and many other illnesses based on the silly idea that one should eat in moderation? What does that even mean? In the class I teach on nutrition and longevity at USC, I ask my students how many calories there are in a bagel. Most think it's around 100 or 150 calories. In fact, most bagels provide between 250 and 500 calories without cream cheese. When I started directing clinical trials in which participants are told exactly what to eat, I discovered that most people have no idea what it means to eat 0.36 grams of protein per pound of body weight per day. Even experienced health journalists have told me, "I wasn't sure if you meant that I should eat 50 grams of protein or 50 grams of food that contains proteins per day." I mean protein, not food that contains protein. This minor misunderstanding alone could cause someone to become malnourished or sick. 50 grams of garbanzo beans contains only 5 grams of protein, just 10% of what adults need to stay healthy. I have also learned that moderation is relative. Consider the following daily menu: a glass of milk, 2 eggs and bacon, a small steak, a slice of cheese, some carrots, some pasta, a chicken fillet, a salad with ranch dressing, a piece of cake, and 2 soft drinks. To many people, this represents eating in moderation. Yet this is the type of diet that has made the United States one of the world leaders in obesity and related diseases. The key to adopting a longevity diet is finding books like this one, written by scientists or clinicians who have mastered as many of the pillars of longevity as possible. Although most healthy people will be able to make these dietary changes on their own, I do recommend, if at all possible, that you consult with a qualified medical doctor or registered dietitian, at least initially, and especially if you have food allergies and might need help personalizing the diet to your needs. You already bought this book, so you're on the right track. As I have said, I based the great majority of dietary recommendations in this book not on my opinion, but on the 5 pillars of longevity and the solid, consistent scientific and clinical evidence they provide. I don't talk about miracle diets or cures, and I stay away from fad diets promising weight loss. Changing your diet to gear it toward healthy longevity will take some work. But it will be much easier than you imagine, and in many cases it will be more beneficial than drug therapies when you factor in both efficacy and side effects. Not to mention saving money on doctors and medications. In the long run, the life-extending benefits will be well worth the effort. I'm confident in these claims because of the positive results achieved by thousands of people I have studied, either personally or through basic research, clinical trials, and genetic and epidemiological studies. I'm also confident because most of my recommendations for everyday diets match the diets of the very long-lived populations that I and other experts like Craig Wilcox in Okinawa have studied. These individuals are concentrated in blue zones, a term coined by Michel Poulin and Gianni Pes, and made popular by author Dan Buettner, to identify longevity hotspots, where diet and physical activity levels are believed to be a key factor in successful longevity. This book also takes into account dietary habits that were common in our history. For example, my disease treatment recommendations in the later chapters of this book, specifically the fasting and fasting-mimicking diets, are based on scientific and clinical studies, but many of these interventions find echoes in ancient practices, such as religious fasting. Historically, religious fasting was not adopted to prevent or treat disease, but since it was common for our ancestors and has now been tested on thousands of people, we know it to be generally feasible and safe. The Five Pillars of Longevity. Most people are discouraged and often confused by nutritional news. Nutrient groups, fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, and also specific foods like eggs and coffee, have all been described in scientific journals and the media as both good and bad for you. How do you decide what's right for you and your health? In fact, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates can be considered both good and bad for you, depending on type and consumption. For example, proteins are essential for normal function. Yet high levels of proteins, and particularly those from red meat and other animal sources, have been associated with increased incidence of several diseases. So we need a better system to filter out the noise and extract beneficial dietary information. This is why I formulated the Five Pillars of Longevity. This method is based on my own studies and also on the studies of many other laboratories and clinicians. It uses five research areas to determine whether a nutrient or combination of nutrients is good or bad for health, and to identify the ideal combination of foods for optimal longevity. I believe that many popular strategies and diets are inappropriate or only partially correct because they are based on just one or two pillars. This is important because while one nutrient may be protective against one condition or disease, it can negatively affect another, or it can protect middle-aged individuals but hurt the very young or the elderly. An example, in adults age 70 and below, eating a relatively high-calorie diet will, in most cases, lead to weight gain and an increase in the risk for developing certain diseases. Yet in individuals over age 70, the same diet and the consequent moderate weight gain can be protective against certain diseases and overall mortality. This is why it is important to follow the advice of someone who has an in-depth understanding of the complex relationship between nutrition, aging, and disease. The Five Pillars of Longevity create a strong foundation for dietary recommendations and a filtering system to evaluate the thousands of studies related to aging and disease, while also minimizing the burden of dietary change. When dietary choices are based on all the five pillars, they are unlikely to be contradicted or undergo major alterations as a consequence of new findings. The Five Pillars of Longevity. Basic/Juventology Research. Without understanding how nutrients, such as proteins and sugars, affect cellular function, aging, age-dependent damage, and regeneration, it is difficult to determine the type and quantity of nutrients needed to optimize healthy longevity. Without animal studies to determine whether a diet can in fact extend longevity, in addition to having acute effects on general health, it is difficult to translate the basic discoveries to human interventions. As I mentioned earlier, I first started working with mice and humans in Walford's lab, but I soon discovered that a far simpler unicellular organism, yeast, could help us identify the fundamental properties of organisms. These could then be applied to humans, furnishing information related to molecular aspects of longevity, in particular the ones linked to evolutionary principles. Using yeast, we were able to generate the differential stress resistance and sensitization theories that served as the foundation for a number of clinical trials testing the effect of fasting-mimicking diets in combination with cancer therapies. This basic/juventology research is where every one of our studies begins. Epidemiology. This is the study of the causes and important risk factors for disease and other health-related conditions in defined populations. Studying population-based risk factors is crucial to testing hypotheses generated by basic research. For example, if you hypothesize that excess sugar promotes abdominal fat storage and resistance to insulin, epidemiological research should confirm that people who consume high quantities of sugars have a high waist circumference and an increased risk for diabetes. After my initial focus on the genetics of aging and juventology, I carried out epidemiological studies related to aging and diseases, which taught me the tremendous value of understanding the health consequences of behavior in large populations. Clinical studies. Hypotheses formulated in basic and epidemiological studies eventually must be tested in randomized controlled clinical trials. This is the gold standard to demonstrate efficacy. For example, a group of pre-diabetic subjects would be instructed to consume fewer sugars but otherwise maintain the same diet and calorie intake as before. The control group would be asked to maintain the same diet or reduce the intake of fat to match the calorie reduction in the reduced sugar group. Understanding the importance of this pillar grew out of my own randomized clinical trials and those of many others, testing the effect of a particular dietary component on risk factors for disease, such as cholesterol or fasting glucose levels, but also on a disease itself, such as cardiovascular disease. Centenarian studies. Once the data from basic/juventology, epidemiological, and clinical studies are available, there is still uncertainty about whether a specific diet or nutritional indication is in fact safe and beneficial after long-term use, and whether it is palatable enough for people not just to adopt it but to stick with it for the rest of their lives. Studies of various centenarian populations from around the world provide long-term evidence of the safety, efficacy, and compliance associated with a particular diet, for example, a low-sugar diet. To generate data for the fourth pillar, I have studied long-lived populations in Ecuador and southern Italy, and consulted the work of my colleagues focusing on other very long-lived populations in high-longevity zones around the world. Studies of complex systems. This pillar is the result of my fascination with reductionism, physics, and the need to simplify the human body's complexity by identifying machines that can serve as models to teach us about the function and loss of function of human organs and systems. This last pillar can complement the others by providing reference points and useful analogies. For example, above I discuss how sugars can lead to disease. But sugars are also the most important nutrient for the human body. Sugar is to the body what gasoline is to a car, the central source of energy. So sugar is not the problem. It's the intake of excessive quantities of sugar in combination with proteins and certain types of fats that contributes to disease both directly and indirectly by activating aging-related genes, creating insulin resistance, and triggering hyperglycemia. This last pillar furthers the analysis of a human problem by taking an engineering approach to generate a relatively simple model to understand the complex interactions between food, cellular damage, and aging. Applying the five pillars of longevity. As an example of how to apply the five pillars to analyze a diet's efficacy, let's examine the very popular high-protein, high-fat, and low-carb diet, such as the Atkins and Dukan diets. Should you go on this diet just because an expert told you that a small clinical trial or even a large epidemiological study shows that it causes weight loss and may lower cholesterol? The answer is definitely not, since when you analyze these diets, they are often based on just one or two pillars, rarely taking into account the entire foundation needed to support the selection of a diet that will optimize health and longevity. These are the diets that tend to get debunked over time. When you look at multidisciplinary studies, you realize that the high-protein, high-saturated fat, and low-carb diet is one of the worst for your health. Populations with record longevity do not eat this way, and theoretical, clinical, and epidemiological studies supporting this kind of diet's long-term and longevity benefits are very few. Also, if we examine the laboratory studies, we see that both high-protein intake and high-saturated fat intake are associated with aging and disease, an additional and key vote against a high-protein, high-saturated fat diet. As you can see, Even when a diet is touted as having been clinically studied, it doesn't mean that it has been studied as rigorously as necessary. So it is always wise to hesitate before adopting a new diet and to look into how many of the five pillars it is based on. As we have shown in both our human and mouse studies, one diet fits most but does not fit all, and the levels of some dietary components must be modified depending on a person's age and physical state and based on his or her genes. In my laboratory, we treat food as a complex mixture of molecules, each capable of causing remarkable changes in your body, which is its own complex mixture of molecules. If it already sounds confusing or difficult to follow, don't worry. I will make it as simple as possible in Chapter 4. Chapter 4. The Longevity Diet. You are what you eat. We all know the saying, you are what you eat. For most people, that translates to avoid junk food. But this popular expression reflects a deeper truth. The food you eat can determine how you look and function, whether you sleep well at night, whether you will stay thin or gain weight, and whether your body shape is more like a pear or an apple. The type of food you eat determines whether your brain will use glucose or ketone bodies to obtain energy, and if you're a woman, the type and quantity of food you eat can affect your chances of becoming pregnant. It's important to eat food you truly enjoy, but it's also important to eliminate or minimize the consumption of food that will make your life shorter and sicker, and to increase the consumption of nutrients that will make your life longer and healthier. Many ingredients aren't just food. They're actually molecules causing remarkable changes in the body. Changes in their levels and combinations can reprogram the function of our cells and organs. As I mentioned earlier, I call the understanding and use of food combinations to control these changes nutritechnology. In this chapter, I will describe briefly what these ingredients are and what they do. Then I will explain their role in aging and disease based on evidence using the five pillars of longevity. I will also focus on the enjoyability of food, an important consideration that can determine how likely someone is to continue with a certain diet. Proteins, carbohydrates, fats, and micronutrients. There are three major components, what we call macronutrients, in the food we eat. 1. Proteins are generally composed of 20 amino acids, whose sequence determines their particular function. For example, a 3-ounce steak contains approximately 25 grams of protein. One of the most abundant proteins in meat is actin, which is involved in muscle contraction and many other cellular functions. After meat is eaten, the digestive system breaks it down into protein and then into amino acids. These amino acids are released first in the stomach and subsequently in the intestine. They are absorbed into the bloodstream as single amino acids or chains of multiple amino acids. Eventually, amino acids are distributed to different cell types throughout the body, where they are used to generate new proteins, including the actin found in human muscle. 2. Carbohydrates are found in most foods you eat, either in their simple form, the sugars in fruit juices, honey, candy, or soft drinks, or in their complex form, the large chains of glucose and other sugars contained in vegetables or grains. Simple sugar can enter circulation immediately, increase blood glucose levels, and trigger the rapid release of insulin by the pancreas. Complex carbohydrates must be separated from other components in food and broken down into simple sugars before they can be absorbed by the body. When analyzing a food's nutritional value in terms of its carbohydrates and their quality, there are a couple of different measures. You've probably heard the terms glycemic index and glycemic load. Glycemic index refers to the effect of a particular food on the levels of blood glucose. Orange juice has a glycemic index of about 50. White bread has an index of 95. A pure glucose drink has an index of 100. However, glycemic index assumes that you are eating a standard portion of carbohydrates. Glycemic load is a more useful measurement because it reveals information about both the characteristics of a specific carbohydrate and its quantity. For example, whole wheat bread has a high glycemic index, 71, but a slice of whole bread has a relatively low glycemic load, 9. Compare that to sponge cake with its relatively low glycemic index, 46, but higher glycemic load, 17. You should be more concerned about the glycemic load since it takes into account both the quality and quantity of sugars a food contains. 3. Fats are the major source of stored energy in the body, in humans as well as in other mammals and simpler organisms. Modified fat molecules also play other key roles in the cells that make up the body, such as a central role in generating the membrane that separates all cell content from the blood, and in generating hormones, including steroids. Fats are mostly ingested in the form of triglycerides, which are composed of three chains of carbon and hydrogen molecules, fatty acids, bound together by a molecule of glycerol. After digestion, they are broken down in the intestine by bile salts released from the gallbladder and by lipase enzymes released from the pancreas and other organs so they can be absorbed into the blood. Fats can be saturated, when the maximum number of hydrogen atoms are bound to each carbon, or unsaturated, when fewer than the maximum number of hydrogen atoms are bound to each carbon. The unsaturated fats can be divided into monounsaturated fats, such as the oleic acid contained in olive oil, or polyunsaturated fats, such as those contained in salmon and corn oil. The polyunsaturated fats omega-3 and omega-6 are called essential fatty acids because the human body cannot generate them, but they are essential for the normal function of cells and organs. In addition to these three major macronutrients, micronutrients are an essential component of nutrition. Micronutrients, such as vitamins and minerals, account for much of the $37 billion U.S. supplement industry. Yet studies by nutrition expert Dr. Bruce Ames and others show that between 50 and 90% of U.S. adults do not get enough vitamin D, E, magnesium, vitamin A, calcium, potassium, or vitamin K. At the same time, several recent articles indicate that dietary supplements containing excess vitamins and minerals are ineffective in preventing major diseases and delaying mortality. One possible exception: a large randomized controlled trial reported a minor reduction in cancer and cataracts in people taking daily multivitamins. Though supplementation with high levels of vitamins and minerals may not protect against aging or diseases, we know they are important for many essential functions of the human body. For example, vitamin D, zinc, and iron are important for normal immune function. Calcium and vitamin D are essential in maintaining normal bone mineral density. A diet rich in vegetables, fish, nuts, and whole grains is the ideal way to get the essential nutrients, but even such diets can be deficient in vitamin D and, for vegans and the elderly, vitamin B12. Most people throughout the world who are consuming what is thought of as a high-nourishment diet have similar deficiencies. Because some studies have indicated that high doses of certain vitamins can be toxic, the ideal recommendation, based on the opinion of both supporters and opponents of supplement use, is to take a multivitamin made by a reputable company that contains at least vitamin D, E, magnesium, vitamin A, calcium, potassium, or vitamin K every 2 to 3 days. As I explained in Chapter 3, looking for common denominators in support of a given supplement's benefit will ensure that you don't adopt a dietary practice that may later be proved unhealthy. It's possible that in the future some vitamins or supplements will turn out to have benefits for some aspects of longevity and health, while others may be detrimental. By reducing the supplementation frequency to relatively low doses and 2 or 3 times per week, we minimize the chance of a toxic effect while still avoiding malnourishment due to a lack of a particular vitamin or mineral. Treat aging, 100 at 50 or 50 at 100. Nutrition is clearly the most important factor you can take control of to affect how long you live, whether you will be diagnosed with certain major diseases, and whether you will be active and strong or sedentary and frail in old age. A recent paper examined nearly 1,000 men and women who were 38 years old. It found that, in terms of their biological condition, some seemed no older than 30, while others appeared closer to 60. Furthermore, all those who were biologically older than their true age would continue to age quickly in later years. My students are surprised when I say some centenarians are healthier and in some ways younger than people who are 50. Clearly, this is limited to very few people and certain organs or systems, but it underlines the relative value of knowing someone's chronological age. Maybe one day we will determine how old someone is based not on the year he or she was born, but on his or her biological age, which we are starting to be able to accurately measure. In the remainder of this chapter, I take advantage of the five pillars of longevity to postpone aging and prevent disease by awakening the body's dormant ability to heal, protect, regenerate, and rejuvenate itself. I would rather die young than have to eat like that. When I talk about the longevity diet, someone usually makes some variation of the following comment. I would rather die young than have to eat like that. It reminds me of the joke about the man who asks his doctor how he can live longer. The doctor recommends he eat very little, give up alcohol, and stop having sex. Are you sure it will work? The man asks. I don't really know, the doctor replies, but no matter how long you live, it will seem an eternity. Fortunately, the longevity diet isn't that restrictive. It allows you to enjoy coffee and alcohol and puts no limit on sex. Contrary to what you might expect, it often requires that you eat more, not less. As I will describe in detail in Chapter 8, a plate of pasta and cheese can weigh just 12 ounces and be very unhealthy, full of bad quality calories. Or it can weigh more than double that amount, about 1.5 pounds, and be very healthy, full of high quality calories, provided you cut down the pasta and cheese to modest portions and add plenty of vegetables and legumes and a generous splash of olive oil. With food, as with most things, people assume anything they want and more of it will make them happier. But that's an illusion. In one of the best TED Talks I've seen, Harvard professor Daniel Gilbert compares the happiness of two groups of people. One group had won the lottery, the other was made up of people who had become paraplegic. A year after the life-changing events occurred, both groups were equally happy. In the same way, one's happiness is largely independent of diet. Adopting a diet that promotes a long, healthy lifespan, contrary to what the doctor in the joke says, doesn't make life an unbearable eternity. In fact, I argue that healthier diets can be superior in taste, since vegetables, legumes, nuts, olive oil, and other plant-based foods provide a much wider variety of ingredients and flavors, compared with unhealthy food rich in saturated fats and sugars that obscure natural flavor. I think of the diet high in saturated fat, red meat, fried food, and cheese as equivalent to the sugary drinks most of us consumed when we were children. Eventually, we grew up and started enjoying red wine instead, yet many of us never abandoned the unhealthy food. But it's never too late. Calorie restriction. Mice, monkeys, and humans. In Chapter 2, I described how mice with defects in the growth hormone receptor gene can live up to 50% longer than those in the control group, and half of them will not develop detectable diseases. I also described how Ecuadorians with defects in the same gene rarely develop diabetes or cancer and appear to have reduced incidence of other diseases. High protein intake, as I explained, causes the activation of the growth hormone receptor, which in turn increases the levels of insulin and insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, whose altered concentrations are associated with diabetes and cancer, respectively. Proteins and certain amino acids derived from them, including leucine, can activate TOR S6K, a set of genes that accelerate aging. Another gene that appears to play a key role in aging is PKA, which we have shown in both simple organisms and mice to be activated by sugars. Mice with reduced PKA activity live longer and are protected against age-related disease. By reducing calorie intake, particularly reducing calories from proteins and sugars, you can decrease the activities of the growth hormone receptor and thus of the TORS6K and PKA genes known to accelerate aging. These findings represent the basic/juventology research pillar necessary to establish how nutrients act on the aging process. As a consequence of not recognizing the connection between proteins and sugars and aging, we have seen the rise over the past 30 years of high-sugar and high-protein diets that have been erroneously labeled healthy. We are starting to accept that a high-sugar diet is unhealthy. Unfortunately, many are turning to proteins and in some cases to bad fats as replacements for sugar. Instead, they should be turning to healthier complex carbohydrates and good fats, as I will explain later in this chapter. Which diets improve longevity? We have known for nearly 100 years that when mice are fed about 30 to 40% fewer calories, they live longer and develop half the tumors and other diseases when compared to the groups of mice receiving a normal calorie diet. An equivalent reduction in a human diet would leave a 6-foot-tall man weighing about 130 pounds. However, since that discovery was made, it's also become clear through multiple further studies of mice and monkeys that chronic caloric restriction can also take a toll. As I mentioned, when I saw my first PhD advisor Roy Walford and the other 7 calorie-restricted individuals upon their exit from Biosphere 2 in Arizona, they looked terrible, and as it turns out, those nearly 2 years of calorie restriction may have cut Walford's life short. He died 12 years later of complications from Lou Gehrig's disease, which many speculate may have been linked to a combination of stress, calorie restriction, and advanced age. So on the one hand, we know that chronic caloric restriction can have profoundly beneficial effects on risk factors for many diseases. On the other hand, we know that chronic and extreme diets, diets that reduce calories by 20% or more and are maintained for long periods or permanently, can negatively affect necessary processes, including wound healing, immune response, and cold temperature tolerance. Put simply, besides making a person extremely thin, the detrimental effects of chronic calorie restriction appear to minimize its benefits by causing a major increase in other types of diseases and conditions that are less well understood. The focus of the rest of this book is on how to obtain the remarkable beneficial effects of calorie restriction without the negative ones. The Longevity Diet. What follows is the optimal diet for minimizing disease and maximizing a healthy lifespan based on the 5 pillars. Follow a pescatarian diet. Aim for a diet that is close to 100% plant and fish-based, limiting fish consumption to 2 or 3 portions a week and avoiding fish with high mercury content, tuna, swordfish, mackerel, halibut. If you are past age 65 and start to lose muscle mass, strength, and weight, introduce more fish into the diet, along with other animal-based foods commonly consumed by populations with record longevity, like eggs and certain cheeses, preferably feta or pecorino, and yogurt made from goat's milk, all of which are commonly consumed in high-longevity areas. Consume low but sufficient proteins. Consume 0.31 to 0.36 grams of protein per pound of body weight per day. If you weigh 130 pounds, that comes to about 40 to 47 grams of protein per day, of which 30 grams should be consumed in a single meal to maximize muscle synthesis. If you weigh 200 to 220 pounds and have 35% body fat or higher, 60 to 70 grams of protein per day is sufficient, since fat cells require lower levels of protein than muscles. Since this minimum requirement can change from person to person, it is preferable to occasionally consult a dietitian to make sure that a healthy, lean body mass is maintained. Protein intake should be increased slightly after age 65 in individuals who are losing weight and muscle. For most people, a 10 to 20% increase, 5 to 10 grams more per day, is sufficient. Finally, the diet should be free of animal proteins, red meat, white meat, cheese, with the exception of proteins from fish, but relatively high in vegetables.